It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strandchamps. Today, hitchhiking.
And it didn't take very long for these dreamways to be recast as highways to hell.
Now, I'm not one to pick up hitchhikers. You never know. Might be a hijacker.
I think the danger of hitchhiking is a little bit of the appeal. It's always like a joke about sex to hitchhike. It's always a joke about danger.
My mother told me never to do this.
You wish he'd taken his mom's advice. Hitchhike to hell. He opened the doors of hell. Hitchhike to hell. There's no such thing as a free ride.
If you watch enough horror movies, you get the feeling that hitchhiking can be hazardous to your health. Very hazardous. But does anyone still hitchhike? Today we'll hear from cult film director John Waters. At age 66, he recently thumbed his way across almost 3,000 miles of American highways. And Israeli radio producer Mishi Harman tries to heal a broken heart by hitchhiking around the world. But first, was hitchhiking ever really as dangerous as the movies made it seem? Ginger Strand is the author of Killer on the Road, Violence and the American Interstate. She told us that back in the Great Depression, when American highways were still relatively new, everyone hitchhiked.
It was entirely normal. Even Emily Post thought that if you were going to your job, particularly during the war, if you were going to your job at a defense plant, it made sense to hitchhike. People picked up soldiers because soldiers used hitchhiking as a way of getting around the country, and that was your patriotic duty, in fact. It wasn't seen as dangerous. It had to be specifically redefined as dangerous, and that happened kind of beginning in the 1950s with the FBI campaign that really picked up in the 1960s.
What was the FBI's anti-hitchhiking campaign, and why were they against hitchhiking?
Well, one theory is that J. Edgar Hoover was really against the fact that students were hitchhiking to the South to register voters and hitchhiking from college to college to take part in demonstrations and protests and civil rights marches and things like that. Hoover particularly hated hitchhiking and saw it as a personal mission to get rid of it. We don't really have the statistics or the evidence to know if it was in fact dangerous.
So are you saying that by the 60s, hitchhiking had taken on certain countercultural associations? It became associated with hippies and flower children?
Absolutely. And the hippies and flower children embraced hitchhiking. You know, it was part of their lifestyle. It was a way of being less materialist because you didn't have to own a car. It was a way of being more connected because you moved from place to place and met strangers and shared things with them, shared a ride, shared conversations. It was part of their entire lifestyle. And so when cities and towns and even some states began passing anti-hitchhiking ordinances, the hippies saw that as a form of harassment.
So how did the FBI actually go about discouraging hitchhiking?
They actually made propaganda posters and placed articles in popular magazines and newspapers. So you see, if you look at the popular media, you see this vast shift from the 1940s and 50s and even the 60s, where hitchhiking is often written up as a reasonable, fun way to get around and an adventure that you can take. And by the late 70s, the only kind of article you read is hitchhiking. It's like playing Russian roulette.
What did those posters look like?
There was a famous one that had a picture of a man in a suit, and he's got his back to the viewer, and there's a car with a family in it. This man in the suit is hitchhiking, and the poster's titled Death in Disguise. And there's kind of a skull superimposed on the whole thing.
Wait, so the hitchhiker was the one who was dangerous?
Yes.
Because that's shifted.
Yes, it did. It shifted in the 1970s with the countercultural embrace of hitchhiking.
Wait, how did it switch from the hitchhiker was the dangerous predator to the people in the car picking up the hitchhiker were potentially predators.
Yeah, I think that what happened is there were a few very high-profile cases of people who used hitchhiking as a means of serial killing. So for every one of those cases, the media just produced a lot of anxiety and fear about hitchhiking.
So aside from the public hysteria, was or is hitchhiking that dangerous?
It's an interesting question because no one's ever actually studied it. There was one report written in the late 70s by the California Highway Patrol, and they looked at all the crimes that were reported over a number of years and how many of them were associated with hitchhiking, and it was significantly less than 1%. If you're looking at reported crimes, it did not increase your chance of becoming a victim.
Wow. Doesn't that strike you as odd that it hasn't actually been that studied?
Yeah, it strikes me as very odd.
I mean, why do you think that is?
Part of me thinks maybe the hippies were right. It could, in fact, be that we're just, as a society, we're more comfortable with people being in their own space. It's why we love our cars. It's very anti the car culture to hitchhike. We think of our cars as private space. It's like inviting a stranger into your home for dinner.
Yeah, well, maybe the powers that be don't especially want strangers meeting up and discovering that they have common interests and like each other.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, there's been a bit of a resurgence. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times pointing out that hitchhiking was not necessarily as dangerous as we've all been led to believe.
Your op-ed basically called for people to start hitchhiking again.
Yes, it did. And I got lots of email from people all over the country pointing out that they were part of various kinds of projects. In today's world, where we're also wired, hitchhiking can be much safer than it ever could. You can take a photo of the car before you step in it, including the license plate, and immediately text that to your mother. People are much more able to protect themselves than they were in the 1970s. There's quite an active hitchhiking culture, although they don't call it hitchhiking, in many cities. Washington, D.C., surprisingly, is one of them. It's known there as slugging. The slugs line up at designated places, and people who want to drive in the HOV lanes pick them up.
I don't know. You said it's safer now with cell phones and you can snap pictures. There's a part of me that thinks, yeah, that just means that maybe they'll catch your killer after you've been left dismembered by the side of the road.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's a question of whether we want to invest in trusting people, whether we want to be the kind of culture that trusts people, or whether we're really committed to our distrust of anyone we don't know.
The point of your book really is that it's not so much the hitchhiker as, in some ways, the highway itself that evokes this sense of fear or unease in us. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, I think so. It's the highway itself, and it's the world that grew up around it and the kind of world that it creates. The highway creates a very disconnected world that's not on a human scale. It's on an automotive scale.
I still don't understand why. I mean, when the highways were built, there was this great sense of national pride. This was a huge public works project. And you can imagine that we might still feel proud of it. And yet, there's these sinister overtones.
Yeah, it's really true. To me, it was very much about economics. When the highway system was first proposed, and when the first highways were built, people loved them. They saw them as beautiful. And it didn't take very long for these dreamways, as they were called, to be recast as highways to hell. And I think that one of the reasons for that is the effect that they had on urban areas and on landscapes. You know, at one point in California, the highway engineers proposed dropping 23 nuclear bombs on the Bristol Mountains in order to carve a path for I-40.
Wow.
Luckily, it didn't happen. But they were going to set up bleachers so that they could bring in dignitaries to watch. Everyone was very excited about this. And people who kind of thought skeptically about that said, this is what the highway system is. It's a kind of war on nature and a war on our landscape.
Ginger Strand is the author of Killer on the Road, Violence and the American Interstate. John Waters has a new book out called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Our producer Doug Gordon did an interview with John Waters recently. And Doug, before we hear that, can we get a little bit of background on who John Waters is? I know he's a really distinctive, flamboyant personality, kind of a cult figure.
Very much so. In fact, he's most famous, Anne, for the cult films he's made. Those films have earned him the nicknames the Pope of Trash and Cecil B. Demented. His black comedy, Pink Flamingos, that he made in the early 70s, it caused a lot of controversy when it first came out because the characters perform a lot of perverse acts in it. And that's probably as much detail as I should go into about that. Or would you like more details?
Well, as curious as I am, it's public radio, so maybe not. So did Waters really hitchhike across America?
He did. Yeah, and he told me that's something he used to do a lot as a kid, and that it was this fantasy he had. Could he hitchhike across America by himself, and what would happen? So 2 years ago, at the age of 66...
Wait, he's 66 and hitchhiking across America?
That's right. 66, 2 years ago, he's 66, hitchhiking from Baltimore to San Francisco, 2,800 miles, and he writes about what happened in the book, of course, but he also writes about what didn't happen, his best-case scenarios and his worst-case scenarios, these fictional accounts. I asked him if imagining these dream rides and nightmare rides was a way of dealing with his anxiety before he left on his trip.
It was hoping and dreading put together, hoping for the best stuff and dreading the worst. And as it got closer and closer, it became more of an abstract idea that what a book deal is than the truth. And I saw the fear in my friends' faces. I saw the kind of reluctance to go along with it with the people that work for me. So, I mean, that started to make me nervous, which kind of got on my nerves because I thought, come on, let's be positive here.
The golden age of hitchhiking is long gone. What happened to it?
I think what happened to it is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre hitchhiker. The Hitcher, the movie. Certainly, I bet there were always serial killers picking up people. I think it was probably always a little bit dangerous to hitchhike, but I think if you hitchhike, the chance of something horrible happen to you, it's much more probable you'll be in a car accident tomorrow than that happening. So everything's a little bit dangerous, and I think the danger of hitchhiking is a little bit of the appeal. It's always like a joke about sex to hitchhike. It's always a joke about danger. It's always the cliches of hitchhiking or genre movies.
The danger, as you say, it's part of the appeal. So I wondered if maybe you had somewhere in the back of your mind this vision of turning hitchhiking into the next big thing in extreme entertainment, you know, along the lines of extreme kidnapping, which people pay to be abducted.
Yeah,
you could have John Waters extreme hitchhiking. You could even hire people to play scary drivers and pick up the clients.
No, I don't want to do that. I did imagine extreme drivers, certainly in the first part of the book, hideous ones. But I don't want to experience that for real. I liked experiencing it in fiction. I was glad that everybody that picked me up was a good driver. I had a cop, I had a coal miner, a trucker, a minister's wife, an African-American girl taking her baby to daycare. I had all kinds of people pick me up. And I would say maybe only a third knew who I was.
Getting back to this idea of the most hideous hitchhiker that you could have was the worst-case scenario of Randy Packard.
Who's a serial killer who only kills cult movie directors. Because everybody said, well, they're serial killers. I said, yeah, I hate to say this, but they usually kill teenage girl runaway hookers, right? And that's a shame, but they don't usually kill 66-year-old men. Even the gay ones, there's one serial killer that was a gay one that just killed, but he went to gay bars and picked them up as a trucker all along the highway. So I tried to think what would be the serial killer that would get me, that would be attracted to me. So I wrote a chapter about Randy Packard, who was, I guess, my ultimate fear. Plus, he had a venereal disease I had never heard of that hadn't been discovered yet. On top of it.
Yeah, to make matters worse. And this would probably be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from the Randy Packard chapter of your book.
We pull into the Las Vegas city limits. Time flies when you're being tortured. I see the ridiculous skyline of the town, a place filled with tourists I have spent my lifetime trying to avoid. Look, Randy, I groan through spasms of pain. Just let me out here. I promise I won't make any trash films again. I'll go make mainstream movies, I swear. It's too late for a career change, Randy snarls with murderous rage as he pulls his truck off the road into an abandoned drive-in movie theater. It's been a long time since any movies were shown here. There's not even a screen anymore, and the concession stand has been burned to the ground. The few remaining poles for the speakers have been stripped clean of working parts. Randy slams on his brakes with a sickening finality. Get in the back, Randy orders. No, Randy, please, I argue. Let's go see the Avengers. Let's go see Hollywood tentpole blockbusters. His answer? A bullet into my right foot. I almost pass out when he grabs me and throws me into the opening he has carved between the truck and the trailer he's pulling. Inside is a cult movie director torture chamber. Josie Cotton's cover version of the theme song of Who Killed Teddy Bear is playing on some sort of sound system. Beneath posters for El Topo is the decaying body of Alejandro Jodorowsky, who I thought was still alive until Randy tells me differently and takes credit. I see George Romero's amputated head hanging in a basket surrounded by posters for Night of the Living Dead and all its sequels. Enough is all Randy offers in explanation. Before I can scream, I trip over what appears to be a corpse clawed away by wild animals. Randy kicks it, and I realize this poor human is still alive. I try to look away, but Randy grabs my head in a chokehold and forces me to gaze upon this nauseating face. Oh my God, it's Herschel Gordon Lewis, and he chuckles when he sees me. He's still got a sense of humor, even as he approaches death.
Excellent reading, thank you. You write about these dream rides, the best case scenarios. Do you have a favorite dream ride?
Well, I guess the first one, the one that picks me up and gives me $5 million to make the movie I've been trying to make in cash and tells me that there won't be any notes and he doesn't really care if he gets his money back or it makes money. And he's a pot dealer that has a corrupt FedEx office that's manned by people that look like they've escaped from the Whole Foods employee jail.
Yeah.
You know that look.
Oh, I know that look. So let's talk about reality now. We have to talk about signage. You wanted to go old school, cardboard signs. Why?
Well, it works. I think it's your ad campaign. Although people think you're a beggar, because the only time they see anybody now with a cardboard sign is when you were standing at a red light begging money. So they, I thought I was so stupid or so schizophrenic that I didn't know that you should stand at red lights. Like, how would I collect change down on the entrance ramp? Like, people run by and hold a basket and they throw quarters at me. That would have been good. I should have tried that.
Should have, yeah. Next time.
The human toll booth. No, set up my own toll booth and see if it worked.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you wrote different things on the signs. Which worked best?
I found out the humor didn't work. I had one that said, I'm not psycho. And people laughed, but they didn't pick me up. And my job is not to warm up the crowd on their way to work in the morning in their cars. You know, it was a comedy routine.
No.
I'm writing a hitchhiking book that never worked, except for cops. That kept cops away. If I saw a cop, I'd pull that one out. And they didn't pull over much. The ones that worked best are just I-70 West. It was a long distance, but it wasn't impossible. I started in Baltimore with a sign that said San Francisco. People just laughed when they saw it. And I don't know what would have been horrible if the book of one person had picked me up and said, I'm going to San Francisco. Get in. It would have been a very dull book. I would have had to jump out. I would have had a escaper ride, which could be good.
Yeah, and do the whole roll, the stunt double roll.
Yeah, the stunt double. I do that in the negative chapters when a junkie hag picks me up and throws me out.
Did you have a strategy if you didn't like the looks of someone who stopped to pick you up? Would you say thanks but no thanks? Or is that a breach of hitchhiker etiquette? Or did that never even happen to you?
Well, it never happened to me. But before you leave, you think, well, would I get in a car with, you know? But the answer is once you're out there for 10 hours, you would get in with anybody. Freddy Krueger, that hitchhiker, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre hitchhiker with that birthmark on his face, I would have gotten in his car.
Ted Bundy even wearing the sling.
Yeah, in a Volkswagen. Yeah, I'd get in anything.
Yeah. Of course, as you and I both know, you are John Waters, the titan of transgressive filmmaking, celebrated author, provocateur.
Well, thank you. My father didn't call me that.
No, not in front of you anyway. But this begs the question, did people recognize you?
Some did, but a lot of them drove past me and said, is that John Waters? Why would it be him? Why would he be standing here? And just like I had a friend that read about it on the internet when the story leaked and called my office and said, so John's had a nervous breakdown. Well, I will come and get him wherever he is in the country. Just tell me and I won't ask him any questions and I'll bring him home. Thought that I had just lost my mind, which I hadn't quite. Some people came over to give me money. A lot of people thought I was just homeless. And then some would recognize me then and start laughing and screaming and wanting to do photo shoots and everything. A lot of people didn't know who I was. And I tried to tell them, if they asked me. One farmer I knew, he didn't believe me, just took out his wallet and tried to give me $10. And I guess that was because he didn't believe me, not that he saw the grosses of my last movie and was trying to help me in my movie career.
One of the major characters in Karsak, besides yourself, of course, is the Corvette Kid. Can you tell me about him?
He was a Republican elected official. I think he's not anymore. I hope this didn't have anything to do with it. Who was in the pouring rain in Western Maryland, my third ride. He was going to the subway shop to get his lunch. And he picked me up. He didn't know who I was. I told him he had never seen any of the movies. Nobody heard. We just kept talking, and he drove me to Ohio, which was 4 hours away, and his parents were freaking. And then he went home, and then he kept saying, I'm going to come get you again. I thought he was kidding, and I'm getting stuck in Kansas, getting stuck in Ohio, hitchhiking and taking days. And finally, I get this ride to Kansas. He said, you're kidding. I've been driving 48 hours at 80 miles an hour, and I almost caught up to you. And I thought, is he kidding? You know, so I said, well, meet me in Denver. And I thought maybe still he was home on his computer, that the whole thing was just kind of like a hacking exercise. But he was there. We had a great adventure. We went over the Rockies. It was totally innocent, but people were incredibly perplexed by it, including his friends, who said things like, way to go, you're with a gay man in a hotel in Reno. What's going on here? And his parents were, I think, very freaked out by it, because if you're worried about your son running off with a hitchhiker and you look me up, it's not great, you know, from a parent's point of view. My career is not exactly who you want your kid to run off with. But it was totally innocent, and we just thought it was funny, kind of, that people were reacting so crazily.
Yeah. Throughout your adventure, you found yourself, as you say, creating these strange backstories for the people you encounter or would see, and you actually wonder, why do I have to turn everybody into a tawdry character? And that thought really struck me, because it makes me wonder, why do you have to
do that? Because I'm a writer. That's a writing exercise. I sit in airports and watch a plane debark, and I make up an instant 30-second biography of each person as they walk out of the plane. That's a writing exercise. Because a tawdry character, they could be the hero or heroine of my movie, it could be a tawdry character. I always imagine drama and melodrama. And so all the characters that I think up are usually extreme in some ways. And so the real people I met were not so extreme. So that was kind of very eye-opening to me, to get along with people that were, I guess, so-called fairly normal compared to the characters that I write.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you would use the word tawdry. That's such a great John Waters word, because that really does capture it. And as I suspected, that is the key to your creative process.
My mother, when she didn't used to like some people I'd bring home, she always would say, who is that creature?
John Waters is a film director and the author of Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. He spoke with Doug Gordon. Now, don't you figure if you're John Waters hitchhiking across America, you have a soundtrack? John put together a playlist of the songs he imagined the characters in his best and worst case scenarios would be listening to when they picked him up.
Most hitchhiking songs are hillbilly music, except Hitchhike by Marvin Gaye, the most famous one, really.
I'm going to Chicago, that's the last place my baby stayed.
So I just went through and did a lot of research and found great hitchhiking music that I always imagined would be playing with my fictitious characters in the book, where in reality, no one ever had the radio on. You would never hear anything, because when you pick up a hitchhiker, somebody has to talk.
Is there one hitchhiking song from your playlist, John, that really captures the essence of this whole odyssey, this whole trip?
That's a good one. I don't have the playlist in front of me, but there's one. I'm a hitchhiker.
I'm a hitchhiker on the road to love. I've been waiting long on this lonely road, waiting for the one I've been dreaming of. For I'm a hitchhiker on the road to love. I'm a hitchhiker with a lonely song. I've been praying you.
Bobby somebody.
Bobby Curtola?
Yeah,
my fellow Canadian, Bobby Curtola, absolutely.
You knew who he was?
Oh, sure, I'm Canadian. We have to know these things.
I know, but tell me who he is.
He's like the poor man's Fabian, the poor man's Bobby Sherman.
But he had hits.
Yeah, in Canada, but does that really count?
Was that a hit in Canada?
Yeah, I think it was. He's a little before my time even, but yeah, that was a hit. Once like someone like Bobby Curtola makes a name for himself in Canada, then, you know, anything he records is a hit.
But did he cross over? Did he come to America and have hits? Because I didn't know that song, and I knew a lot of obscure music like that.
Yeah.
So he was like Fabian, Bobby V, that kind of...
The Great White North version of those guys, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I shouldn't diss him that much.
No, I think it's a great song.
I'm a hitchhiker with a lonely song. I've been praying you would soon come along.
gonna ride with you to the stars above. For I'm a hitchhiker on the road to love. For I'm a hitchhiker on the road to love.
Bobby Curtola with his 1961 song Hitchhiker. The song made it to number 4 on the Canadian charts, but failed to hit the American charts. Coming up, Mishi Harman, the Ira Glass of Israel, tells the story of an epic hitchhiking trip he took to win back his ex-girlfriend. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Breakups cause people to do all kinds of things. Some shave their heads, some binge-watch House of Cards, and some hit the open road, as in the story we're about to hear. If you've been following To the Best of Our Knowledge the last few months, you'll know we're collaborating with Sipur Israeli, or Israel Story, the This American Life of Israel, now entering its second season in Hebrew. It's one of the most popular radio shows in Israel, and especially now, with all of the depressing news coming from that region, it brings stories that try to humanize and complicate things. This one is from Mishi Harman, the host of Israel Story.
At the end of the summer of 2008, my long-term girlfriend, who I was sure I was going to marry, broke up with me. And one of the things that she said when we were breaking up was that I wasn't flexible enough. And I was just about to move to Cambridge, England to start grad school. And even though I didn't exactly know what she meant, I was completely devastated. It plain old sucked. And really the only thing that I could think about was how to get back together to Natalie. And that's actually not her name. She asked me not to use her real name on the radio, which I think you'll soon understand why. And you know how you kind of think these irrational thoughts? So I signed up to yoga studios and started going to Pilates lessons and stretching every morning. And then one rainy night, I was walking from the archaeology department to my room in Pembroke College, and I suddenly had this idea. I sort of figured it out. And if I really wanted to be flexible and I wanted to show her that I had become flexible, I needed to put myself in some situation where I had no control over what went on. So I rushed to my room and I cut out a cardboard square and scribbled anywhere in these big blue all cap letters. And then just went outside, ready to hitchhike to, well, anywhere. Even though this was designed as this sort of no destination kind of trip, it's hard to shed years of inflexibility in just a second. So I harbored this secret desire that if things went really, really well, I would end up in Seville, in Spain. So, growing up, my brother always told me about his favorite paradox, which is about the barber of Seville who shaves all the men in town who don't shave themselves. And the question is, does he shave himself or not? Because if he does, then he shouldn't, and if he doesn't, then he should. And I was going through all these mind loops about Natalie, and I thought to myself that I really identified with this poor barber, and I really need to go and find this barber and get some tips about life from him. At the beginning, not many people stopped. But I was just standing on the side of these British freeways, and most of the people would slow down, take a look at my sign, kind of smile, and whiz off. My first ride was this Pakistani guy who was refilling soda vending machines, and then I got a ride with these members of a teenage punk band who stopped to rehearse in someone's basement. And then a few days later, I found myself in an all-night internet cafe in London where some gay Moroccan guy stole my Nikon D40 camera, which was highly unfortunate. But I was having a blast, because flexibility was like, I was just on a flexibility roll. And Natalie was going to be so, so surprised. I figured that I should really chronicle this journey for her. So I decided that I was going to write her postcards, one postcard every day, to tell her what I was experiencing. But very quickly, I was experiencing way too much for just one postcard. So it became two postcards a day, and three postcards, and four, and sometimes five or six or seven. And I was nuts, but I wasn't crazy. So I knew that she would be completely overwhelmed to receive all these unsolicited postcards from me all the time. So I would just put a stamp on the postcard and put it in my bag and keep it for some future day where I would give her this whole package. And there was another project going on, which was that on the flip side of the Anywhere sign, there was an equally important slogan, and it said, "I love you, Natalie." And my idea was to get people along the way to hold up this sign, and I would take a picture of them, and then I would have a world of people expressing my love. So anyway, I got onto this van of Roma people who were going to Holland, who put me onto the ferry from Dover in England to Calais in France. And on the ferry, I went to the truck driver's cafeteria to see if anyone was going to Spain. And there were plenty of people going to Spain. But no one agreed to take me, even though I had cut my hair and I didn't at all look like, as my mom would say, a wildecaya, a wild animal. And the only guy who really agreed to talk to me was this guy called Vladimir, who was this tall guy with dark hair who didn't speak a word of English. And I went to him and I said, "Vladimir, where are you going?" And he said, "Spain." So I said, "Spain, that's great. Can I come with you?" And he didn't understand what I was saying, so he said yes. And then about half an hour later, I noticed that he took this unexpected left-hand turn into Belgium. And I looked at him and I sort of pointed to the south and said sort of, you know, anxiously, "Vladimir, Spain, Spain." And he looked at me completely confused and sort of with deadpan seriousness said, "No, no Spain, Ukraine." And I thought to myself that if there was ever a moment to practice my flexibility, this was my moment. So for the next 4 days, Vladimir taught me how to drive his truck. And for the next 4 days, we went on all these sideways because Vladimir was trying to dodge the tolls and didn't talk at all. And then on the Slovenian-Ukrainian border, we were detained for a cell in a day because it turned out that Vladimir's entire truck was full of counterfeit Barbie dolls that he was trying to smuggle into the Ukraine. And then finally, once they realized that I wasn't part of the Barbie doll scheme, they let me go. And I ended up in Moscow, and I was left at the central train station, and I got onto this train, which I didn't totally realize was the Trans-Siberian Railway, which crossed all of Russia, all of frozen Siberia, the Gobi Desert, Mongolia, and ended up 9 days later in Beijing. There were almost no Westerners at all on the train. It was only Russian farmers going from one small village to another. And every night there were these crazy vodka parties in the cabin with like 30 different guys called Boris. And every few hours the train would stop at various different towns to let people on and off. And I would run out to the town with my sign and get people to hold it up with the "I love you, Natalie" sign. The pile of postcards was also growing and growing. And I was kind of thirsty for this wisdom about life. And I had met this weird Canadian hockey fan in some youth hostel in Kiev who quoted Wayne Gretzky, who said, "You miss 100% of the shots that you never take." And then a few weeks later, when the train stopped in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, finally a Westerner came aboard, this beautiful Swedish drifter called Lisa, who told me that her life motto came from John Lennon. "Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans." And it just so happened that when I got to Beijing, it was the Jewish holiday of Passover. So I went to a Chabad Seder in some huge function room of a hotel. And I sat down next to this really gorgeous Israeli girl. And I was telling her all about my hitchhiking adventure. And she was clearly very, very excited. And then she said, you know what? This is great. Why don't we continue your adventure and hitchhike together to India? And I thought to myself, who needs a degree from Cambridge anyway? And she said, yeah, and we can stop in Tibet and pick up my boyfriend, Udi. And I was like, your boyfriend, Udi? And even I realized that this was a sign. So I hitchhiked to the Beijing airport, and I asked the Chinese travel agent there what the cheapest flight that he had to anywhere west of there that day. So he started typing into his computer, and then he looks up at me and says that I'm in luck because there's a cheap flight that leaves in a couple of hours and still has room. And I was like, oh, that's great. Where is it to? And he looked down at the computer and looked back up at me and said, to Spain. So I did end up in Seville, and I did go to a barber. He couldn't have been farther from my fantasy. I had imagined this sort of fat, balding, sweaty Spaniard called Juan Carlo o Pedro with this huge mustache, spouting out words of wisdom about life and living within a paradox. But in reality, his name was Mustafa, and he was 20 years old, and he was a new immigrant from Algeria, and he didn't speak any language that I spoke. And the Andalusian music of my fantasy in reality was actually Celine Dion's theme song from Titanic. And he didn't give me any words of wisdom. A few months later, taking up Wayne Gretzky and, I guess, completely ignoring John Lennon, I moved back to the States to be close to Natalie to try to get back together. And on her birthday, I invited her over to my place to present her with this huge labor of love, this album of dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of pictures of people all over the world holding up the sign. A whole world of people expressing my love. And in the drawer, there was a pile of 300 plus postcards in my tiny, tiny handwriting, ready to be presented at the climactic moment of reconciliation. I began by giving Natalie the album, and she opened it up on some random page and sort of smiled and closed the book. And then, at least this is the way I remember it, she got up, put on her coat, and walked to the door. And I said, your album. And she looked at me and she said, oh, was I supposed to take that? All this happened many years ago, but this story has become, I guess, my favorite story in life. And I've told it countless times. I've told it basically on every single first date that I go on. It's like my all-star story. You know, when you tell a story so many times, you sort of kind of lose the experience of it actually happening to you. It sort of just becomes a good story. But when I really try to go back and think about what that journey meant to me, I wonder whether I actually became more flexible. I mean, I guess the truth is that I don't know, right? I mean, probably not. But, you know, I think, like, would I do something again like that? I mean, is that just something that someone in their mid-20s does because they're slightly kind of crazy? And I would like to think, yeah, that is kind of the person that I am, this kind of slightly crazy romantic who, you know, hitchhikes to China to try to prove to some girl who then doesn't even take his album that they've become flexible, when, in fact, they haven't become flexible. So, that's that.
That was Mishy Harman. You can find all the other Israel Story pieces we've aired on our website at ttbook.org. And if you like them, tune in to Israel Story's first season in English on the Vox Tablet podcast beginning August 18th. And that's it for our conversation about hitchhiking. But coming up, England's top literary prize is now open to Americans. Joshua Ferris made this year's long list with a novel about a very grumpy dentist. And we'll hear this week's dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, this is Peter Edelman. I'm a law professor at Georgetown Law Center in Washington, D.C. Here's my dangerous idea. Putting people to work doing things we need done as a country. The unemployment rate is stubbornly high, and we have a considerable list of things that we urgently need to do. Doing something about it sounds good to me. The dangerous thing is that we'd have to pay for it. The conventional wisdom is that we can't afford it. I'd say we can't afford not to. It's worth the cost because what we do will pay off for our children and our future. We have a long history on this. The interstate highway system, the railroads, our public schools and public libraries, the money we put into housing after World War II. All of these put Americans to work, and all of them involve public dollars. History's on our side. So what do we need now? One, infrastructure. Not much need to elaborate there. Everybody talks about it. Roads, bridges, sewers, ports. We have to figure out how to pay for it and get on with doing it. Two, investing in our children. We need to get every child ready for school, and we need to attract the great teachers. We need to give all of our children a chance. Three, build housing. We've been losing affordable housing for more than 30 years. To take on these and other tasks facing our nation, we will need to pay not only for the jobs themselves, but also for the education and training necessary for men and women to do the jobs. We have to do it. Our economy depends on an infrastructure that works. Our children, all of them, need the skills to succeed in the 21st century and hold our own in the struggle to keep up with globalization. Let's start with 2 million jobs doing tasks that people are ready to undertake without much additional training. $100 billion a year would get us started. 3 years ago, Illinois Representative Jan Schakowsky introduced the Emergency Jobs to Restore the American Dream Act. For millions of Americans, the emergency continues. My dangerous idea would make a phenomenally important difference for people all over our nation who deserve a better deal than what they have now.
Peter Edelman with his dangerous idea. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. It's time for On Our Minds, and this week, the long list for Britain's Man Booker Prize is out. And for the first time ever, it includes 5 Americans. It's one of the most prestigious literary awards in the world, and it's kind of a big deal that it's now open to writers from outside the UK. So one of the Americans on the list is Joshua Ferris for his novel To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's the story of a dentist with an attitude and will teach you more than you ever wanted to know about teeth. Joshua Ferris sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about and read from the book. Here's how it begins.
The mouth is a weird place, not quite inside and not quite out, not skin and not organ, but but something in between. Dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate. Where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up.
That is great. How would you describe Paul O'Rourke, the dentist, in your story?
Well, he's a little at odds with the world. He's a little aggrieved at various things. He should be very happy.
He's very successful, a successful dentist on the Upper East Side of New
York. He's a fine dentist. He's making a lot of money. He should be relaxed. He should enjoy his comforts, but he just can't. He can't get along with the people in his office, not through really any fault of their own. He is made constantly aware of the forces at play on people because they come in with mouths wrecked in accidents and neglected mouths and cavities that simply refuse to be filled. And he's just on alert at all times at the way in which the world is working against him and his deeper wishes. And so he's a little lost. He's adrift and doesn't really feel like he belongs anywhere. And as such, he gets a lot of his animus from complaint.
Well, and my sense is he's more than just a little adrift. If you sort of poke beneath the surface of Paul O'Rourke, there's a kind of existential panic there. There's a sense that it doesn't add up. I mean, there's no kind of underlying purpose to his life.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he's looking for something and does not know what that is. And he's also an avowed atheist, so he has no real option in terms of a deep religious community. And the separation from that makes him even more anxious than he might ordinarily be.
The questions about faith and religion run throughout this book. And Paul, as you mentioned, is an atheist, but he seems to be fascinated by religion. And he seems to kind of pine for people of faith who belong to a religious community. He wishes he could do that, but because he doesn't believe in God, he can't. Does that resonate for you?
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm like a white guy, right? I'm just sort of a white male by all appearances, a WASP, I suppose. So I'm kind of welcome anywhere, but I belong nowhere. When I went into college, I saw from the outside in for the first time a lot of subcultures, some of them religious, some of them not. But I did long for some kind of connection on a deeper level that I had never had.
And so you did not grow up religious?
I grew up sort of religious. The Christianity from which I came, all you really had to do was profess your faith. You just sort of had to declare that you believed in God, and then you were saved. You didn't have to do much, you know? So in an interesting way, this was sort of like an orthodoxy, a singularity of belief. What I liked about other religions was a kind of orthopraxy. The way in which they practice was very different from that. So the practice of religion, as I saw it in others, in Catholics and in Jews and in friends of mine who belonged to other religions, they were practicing that religion. They were enacting it either on a weekly or even a daily basis. And while that seemed like a big fuss to me, it also seemed to come with some serious dividends.
Well, you have a passage in the book where you sort of reflect on these questions of atheism and belief, and I'm wondering if you could read that.
Sure. The most unfortunate thing about being an atheist wasn't the loss of God and all the comfort and reassurance of God, no small things, but the loss of a vital human vocabulary. Grace, charity, transcendence, I felt them as surely as any believer, even if we differed on the ultimate cause, and yet I had no right words for them. I had to borrow those words from an old dead order. And so while it was not a word I used, when I fell in love with Connie and became acquainted with the Plotzes, I felt blessed.
That's good. Thanks. Now, the central event that happens in this story is that Paul's professional identity is stolen. Someone comes along, makes a website, pretends that it is about Paul's dental practice, and it's not. Tell us what happens.
Well, he's not just an avowed atheist. He's very determined to stay off the internet, despite the fact that he can't get enough of his iPhone. So when he discovers that somebody has made an entire homepage for his dental practice, he's really flummoxed. It's not something that happens every day. And he also feels deeply violated. The picture of him on the about page is surveillance grade. It makes him look like he's wanted by the FBI. So he's very confused. And naturally, he needs to set out to find out who's done this to him and why. And that sort of sets him on the path toward discovering that he may or may not belong to an ancient religion, And he's got to determine not only if this religion is real, but if he in fact is a member of it.
What's the ancient religion?
It's called the Olms.
Which is, in your story, it's based on an actual tribe in the Bible, right?
That's right. The Olms as a people are generated from the Amalekites in the Hebrew Bible. The Amalekites are the ancient sworn enemy of the Israelites. And once they go from being the Amalekites to the Olms, in a very similar way to the way in which the Israelites became the Jews at some point, they change their theology entirely and become something that an atheist like Paul may find intriguing.
So you've created this new religion, Olmism, right?
I have. It's sweeping the nation as we speak.
Was that fun to do?
It was great fun. But I was compelled to write it because I felt at odds with the reigning belief that unless you have a faith in God, you can't join a group. You can't really join a religious group. If you're a spiritual person, you may have religion in one respect, in that you commune with the Almighty, you commune with the Eternal, but you don't really join a community. And so you really have to kind of buy into one brand to commune. And that seemed, I don't know, unfortunate. And I wanted to give this person, this character of mine, the opportunity to commune with a group of people who may in fact be insane, but nevertheless are his.
Now, the piece of the story in your novel is that a lot of this plays out on the internet. Paul is outraged at the idea that his identity has been stolen. There's been this whole fabricated story about himself on his website, or not his website, but pretending to be his website. And then he gets kind of sucked in to the idea about this strange religion, and he becomes sort of fascinated by it.
Yeah, I wanted to find out what the interstices were between religion as an ancient form and the internet as a novel communication tool. Where did they link up? What's possible in this brave new world of online exchanging with respect to these ancient ways of thinking? And so I was really interested in seeing how a religion might be created whole cloth on the internet. So that was a lot of fun for me and part of the reason to write the book.
Joshua Ferris is the author of To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's just been long listed for the Man Booker Prize. Ferris spoke with Steve Paulson. And you can find the extended interview on our website, ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Will Henkes. Special thanks this week to engineer and audio artist Joe Hartke. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.